welcome back to the Mind Vector Podcast.
If you're a returning listener and would like to support the podcast, give us a like and a subscribe.
And if you'd like to share your thoughts, leave them on our YouTube, BitChute, or Facebook.
Well, in the...
Okay, we're recording.
In our Discord, we were talking about... I started talking about considering canceling my Amazon because of how badly they treat their warehouse employees. And then I think that kind of led us into talking about capitalism and economics and stuff. And then that led us into talking about Marxism.
Oh, I thought it was the homeschool video that did it.
Well, for me, yeah. That was the first. So I was swiping around on Instagram and that homeschool lady was on there and she tagged the video or her little post or whatever. Said Hegelian dialectics. And I was like, what the fuck is that? So I'm like going down this rabbit hole and looking up Hegel and Marx and all that and how they're all tied together.
Yeah. So to the listeners, to explain what Hegel is, there was a German philosopher in the first quarter of the 1800s. His name was George Hegel. And the dude is really interesting from what we've been reading about him. But apparently his philosophy influenced Karl Marx quite a bit. And Karl Marx is another kind of a political philosopher that I'm sure everybody knows most people know who Karl Marx is. So the Hegelian dialect, to explain that, basically he put forth this notion that discourse is how different points of views sort themselves out into the truth, basically. So mm-hmm. It's kind of like clashing ideas and perspectives are kind of like a formula that equals whatever the truth will be. And it's important to go back and even dig into the old ways of thinking and seemingly bad ideas just to make sure that it really was a bad idea and there wasn't a little bit of truth in it. So the stages in which that happens were, he broke them up into three stages: the thesis, the antithesis, and synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
So that that simplification kind of sheds light into why a lot of different ideologies have like a dualistic type of left-right division in them.
Mm-hmm.
And this influenced Marx quite a bit because he basically used that way of thinking. That's how we got social conflict theory. So a lot of people also argue that people that are aware of how this dynamic works is, it means for the government to exploit. So the state can put forth a problem if they want to enact a policy that would seem like a solution.
Yeah, it's a form of like mass manipulation of the masses, of the masses, of society. So, you can take a classic example of 9/11 and the conspiracies floating around that it was by design to get people all behind a cause in order to get their desired outcome. So they pose a solution and people jump on the bandwagon, but it's all by design. So that conspiratorial aspect of it was what kind of got me into it. But I think Hegel and mostly Marx though gets a bad rap, but really I think he's in the kind of the same boat as Hegel in that he was just theorizing. He was just like, you know, he was just philosophizing. He wasn't, although it was more of a what to do, because Hegel gets a bad rap for being a little too obscure, because he wasn't, his language just wasn't very clear, and it you really have to read into his stuff, and it's not apparent what he's really trying to say. And then Marx just took his formula and ran with it and kind of made more of a more of a how-to, like a purpose. He gave it a purpose behind what Hegel was trying to do, which I don't think Hegel was trying to do anything, and then Marx was. He actually wanted, it's like the school of Hegel split off into two different schools, and you get the left and then the right. So the left wanted, they interpreted that Hegel wanted a revolution. So Marx, he really gets a bad rap for starting this whole thing, but I think he was kind of in the same boat as Hegel was, in that he was just philosophizing on how to do it. But I don't guess they were quite there. And another aspect of the Hegelian dialectic is how we acquire knowledge and how it's kind of transformative. It's an evolution of knowledge. It's not just like one snapshot and that in and of itself. If you look at it as like a good metaphor for it is that you don't interpret an acorn as all that it's going to be. It's going to blossom into, you know, a plant, into an oak tree. Same thing with like a butterfly. You don't just see the caterpillar as a caterpillar. It's going to evolve into something else. And so you can't just take things out of context like that. You have to look at the whole picture across time and space and all that. And so I think we're at a point now in that whole school of philosophy where people are actually, now that it's the philosophy has evolved to a point where people are taking action. And yeah, Marx was instrumental in developing that whole aspect of it, but I don't necessarily believe that he had the worst intentions, because they were both very they wanted freedom of thought. They wanted freedom of being, and for you to be. It was all with good intentions, from what I can tell. And because they both hate, I mean, especially Marx hated the servitude aspect. So he believed that if we were all free of economic burden, that we would be able to further ourselves as people. But I think he failed to take into account human nature, which is that we adjust to our conditions. So that even if you start making, you know, a higher income, you get used to that and then you want more. You know, you look at your cell phone and you want the next best thing. So we're kind of insatiable.
Unless
in
you're
that way.
Really cheap like me. We're going.
Yeah, how old is your phone? I'm just content with what I've got. I haven't upgraded. I don't see a need. I'm not going to, you know, don't fix what ain't broke.
Yeah.
But
not everyone's like us, though.
Not everybody is. And that's, I mean, we kind of fight our nature in wanting more in that regard. But not everybody is that conscious.
Yeah.
And so the masses are always going to want more. And so once the economic burden is out of the equation, what's left? Power and status. And so that's why it doesn't work. That's why Marx plan doesn't work, because it only actually makes things worse in terms of conflict.
Yeah, and I agree. I would like to think that basically his intentions weren't for things to play out like the way they did in, you know, communist Russia and things like that.
Right.
Like the leftist anarchists, if they're actually staying true to what they believed, it would probably just look like a bunch of hippies or nudist colony or some type of cult out in the woods that just smokes weed and probably grows their own crops and trades with other little settlements doing the same thing, which mm-hmm. isn't all that different from, you know, what capitalists want. It's just they want money to be able to be the means to do that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the inversion of those two far sides of the left-right spectrum, at least in the anarchy sense.
Which, in an ideal world, if everybody thought the same way and everybody was on board, you know, on that benevolent mentality, it would work. But not everybody's that way. You know, we got some psychopaths out there that, you know, just want power. And
yeah, and some people are just only driven by status, like you said, which is, you know, I've seen people get into the whole fear of automation thing. And for them, the way that vision plays out is that basically only the rich will have access to these amazing technologies that can yield like endless resources. And then people will just be disposable and they won't have any purpose. But I don't see it playing out like that, because like you said, it's in our nature as well. Not everybody, but there's aspects of human nature. Some people are more competitive in a way, so they'll find ways to be productive. They'll find ways to provide value. And some people may get that technology and not even want to, you know, monopolize it. Like, look at Elon Musk, for example. Like, the dude is wealthy and he keeps trying to figure out ways to make things cheaper, more accessible, and more affordable for everybody. Like,
yeah, his motivation is to make an impact on the world for the better. He wants to improve the world.
See,
but not everybody is in it for the world. They're in it for themselves. It's a selfish pursuit. Which, if you think about the whole selfish pursuit thing, it's like, from an evolutionary standpoint, that's a beneficial trait to have when resources are scarce. So it's in our DNA to want to acquire and acquire and acquire, because it meant, back in the day, it meant survival. It meant your survival. So I think the majority of people are that way. And I don't think it's an entirely immoral thing. I think it's just our nature.
Yeah, definitely. And there were two videos that I watched regarding this, and I'll link them in the description on our BitChute. We've been having issues with BitChute and haven't been able to upload on time, but I'm trying to work that out. But anyway, in one of the videos, one thing that I thought was really interesting regarding the Hegelian perspective is that it's worth retreading bad ideas to pull things out. And I notice a lot of people look at selfishness as a bad thing, and it's kind of something that's associated with at least us on the right, or people that aren't Democrats or, you know, liberals or leftists. But if people are driven by things like that, like ego, it can still manifest in a way that's beneficial to everybody. So like you were saying, when it comes to people like Elon Musk, who want to leave their mark on the world in a good way, that's something that a lot of us will benefit from. So to limit it and say that that selfishness, that's ego, I mean, it's not wrong, but it's not bad. So being able to appreciate that distinction is important.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you think about it, if you were as smart, if you were a wealthy genius like Elon Musk, what would you do with that? Most people wouldn't care about, you know, helping the world or whatever. They would just do their own thing and just climb the hierarchy, as they would say.
Yeah, and for people that aren't, like, I have a friend who's like that. Like, I know he's very competitive and he likes to kind of be at the top and do everything the best he can. And I know I'm not exactly like that. I know I can be kind of corner cutting in a lot of ways, but for people like me, I don't know exactly what I would do with that much money. And as I said in a previous episode, that the Taoist perspective of these things going back and forth and being part of a natural cycle, that's something that kind of echoed when I was reading more about the three stages that the Hegelian perspective puts forth, is that it's a natural process, and how our you know, the human race is going to grow. So we have to go through bad things. We have to repeat bad history, unfortunately. So
yeah, and in terms of like global growth, I don't think we're at the top. Like, as U.S. or whatever, we're kind of in the middle. Well, a little closer to the top. But if you look at like the U.K. and how civilized they are to their own detriment, because now they're having all these problems with mass immigration and they aren't fighting back. So in a way, it's like when you become too civilized, even to your core, like at the genetic level, because it is a trait, it is a genetic trait. It can be a bad thing, because then you go extinct, you know, somebody else takes over and you're done.
Yeah. Basically cultures can get wiped out that way. You know, I had, someone that was arguing, or, you know, immigration to me, say something like, well, you know, this was originally the Native Americans' lands and they had an open border policy. And I'm like, yeah, look how well that worked out for them.
So. Yeah, but they were like, I think I was listening to Joe Rogan talking about the Comanches in a couple episodes back. He's like getting all into like reading about them, and they were savages. They killed so many settlers that it and their culture overall, it was extremely savage. Like they were just used to all this blood and gore and violence, and it was like it was no thing to them. It was just the way they were.
Yeah.
So
the idea of life being precious is kind of it's a newer thing. It's something that we've had a luxury to realize.
Yeah, but so up until that point, they were top dogs until, I guess, they invented better technology to get them under control. But I mean, that's, if it weren't for the settlers having that issue of the Comanches, they would not have invented whatever, I guess, gun it was that they invented. Or I think it was, he was talking about the Texas Rangers, that they were like a special force that was put together to like annihilate the Comanches. They were like trained.
Yeah.
But so you have the antithesis, the thesis, and then the reaction, right? They reacted to that problem. The settlers did.
Yeah. Yeah. And
so, I don't know, that's, competition.
That's a, that was another useful thing I've taken from reading about this. Hegel described like a constitution of a nation as like the nation's mind, which, you know, I've spoken about the term collective egos before, and that is, again, that's kind of the same type of thinking in a different language. But that is one thing that I do like the idea of, is that a nation should be people with the same values. So, like you said, if you have a situation where you're bringing in people that don't really value the same way of life, and they're replacing the population that is there that does value that way of life, you're going to see a huge cultural shift, and it's going to look like basically whatever the majority is that's coming in. So as far as like the United States' growth, that's not, like, as far, I don't know if you meant growth in terms of population or if you meant like economic growth or what.
I meant like mental, like developmental, like we're not as uncivilized or whatever.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so, but going back to Marx and Hegel, so those processes of like the thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, that turned into social conflict theory, which is this idea that individuals and groups of people, they only interact with the goal of power in mind. So, like you said, they'll end up competing for status and other things once the economic thing. Let's say if you lived in like a, you know, a fantasy land where everybody could be economically equal, or you know, everybody's just poor, then the thing that would still change that is that the fact is that everybody's different in different ways. So if people are competing for power, like in the Marxist perspective, there's still going to be something that would drive them out of that. And it's kind of part of the cycle too, is if they figure out that the nation has kind of lost its mind, so to say, people will start rising up to do something about it. So
yeah, because I mean, people don't like it when they're, when we're the same. That it's like that competitive aspect is always going to be there, even just a little bit. I'm not saying it's going to be the same for everybody, but more for some than for others. It's like, you're not going to want to wear the same clothes as everybody. You know, if everything's equal and everybody can afford the same things or can only afford the same things, I mean, you're still going to want to stand out in some way for status or for power or whatever. It's like, you think about, you, people take for granted all the different ways that are different positions in life manifest in a material way. And I think people don't think about that, but if you were to think about everybody as like carbon copies, then I think it would be a bigger issue than we realize. But it's kind of a mental exercise. But yeah, we're always looking for bigger and better, so that doesn't really work. The Marxist model.
Yeah, and I think giving way for those differences in personality is probably what's going to lead to the best quality of life for people, instead of trying to make everyone fit the same mold, because...
Yeah, because we need that flexibility.
People are pretty miserable whenever he tries to get enacted out, like in public school, for example. So,
mm-hmm. The girl on that dating profile that said that she was a wage slave.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, but then if everyone's a wage slave, everybody's going to be that miserable. I mean, we're still going to be slaves to something, even if it's not a wage. It's always going to be something else. It's going to manifest in some other way. And it just creates more unhappy society.
Yeah, which...
In a deeper way. Because, I mean, money's a tool.
That's something that I've been thinking about, too, when it comes to what I've learned from listening to Jordan Peterson's tying the big five personality traits with at least the political divide.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that interesting thing that leftists are higher in neuroticism. So they're always the people that are the
more unhappy.
Yeah, they're unhappy. Or the antithesis, they're the people that kind of embody that role. So mm-hmm. when it comes to situations like that, it's kind of a weird thing that plays out, because people seem like they have to make this delusion work more. And it probably just makes them more and more unhappy, because they're having to kind of suppress reality in a way. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's good for the psyche to try to look at the world intentionally in a backwards way, unless you can kind of separate yourself from it and maybe learn something from how someone may be thinking, and that's not the way you think personally.
Yeah, it all depends on how you look at it, though, because...
I don't think most people do that, though.
Yeah, that mental flexibility of muscles all weak. But I can understand their frustration with wanting things to be better, and with certain people wanting to just keep keep things the same, if not take a step back or trim the fat or whatever, in like the government and the system and the state and all that. And so they dig their heels in that way. But I think the way that the right or the conservatives think of it is that they don't see it as it's not demotivational for them to be. It's motivation. If you're stuck in a place and you want to get out, it's motivation for you to improve yourself and do something else. Do what's going to work. Find a different way and make your own path, as opposed to somebody handing it to you. Because when somebody hands something to you, it's like you take it for granted anyway. It's like, I didn't work for this. You know, so, I mean, it's like, ooh, yay, shiny at first. But then it's like, as easily as it was given to you, it's going to lose its appeal.
Yeah, that's true. Easy come, easy go.
Yeah.
And if we did live in a world where the things we wanted could be just given to us in an instant, we would be pretty unhappy. Which, you know, it's probably explaining why depression and anxiety is off the charts right now.
Because people don't... Because... meaning is lost.
The meaning is lost. Like, if all these things were just instant joy, then the happiness and the contentment from it is... It's not as long-lasting. So... And for a lot of people, too, I think there is something in our nature that likes that strife to some degree. And I think sometimes that's why we find ourselves in such a kind of a fierce ideological state right now. Like, you know, people called it the Cold Civil War. But finding ourselves in that state, too, I think it's the product of things just getting so good now is that we're kind of making up things to fight about. Speaking of like things being given away freely, apparently Andrew Yang's no longer running.
Yeah, he decided to chill. He realized he wasn't going to get anywhere with that.
I didn't really agree with any of his policies, but he seemed like a reasonable dude. Except, well, I shouldn't say reasonable, but...
Nice guy.
Yeah, there we go. So, he didn't seem as predatory
as
some of the other candidates. But I don't agree with, like, any of his policies.
Yeah.
If I was a leftist, though, he would have been who I would have voted for if I was still, like, in the socialist mind state.
Yeah, him and Tulsi Gabbard, I think, were my top. I think more Tulsi Gabbard than Andrew Yang. Because she seemed a little more grounded as far as military and people and stuff. Which, he's a family guy, but I don't think he's got a whole lot of... He's too much in his philosophy, his own idea of the way things should be.
Yeah, and, well... That's another thing, too, that was interesting in one of these other videos is they pointed out that for liberals, the way they define freedom, because... It's important to note that even though you speak with people and use the same words, they don't have the same meaning for both of you. But when leftists hear of freedom, they don't really think it exists. Like this guy, Peter Singer, he ended up saying that for liberals, not having absolute control of their destiny means that freedom doesn't exist.
Mm.
So,
well, doesn't that include the freedom to fail?
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, too. That freedom...
It's like you want to be freer, but you also accept the risk that you might fail.
Yeah.
And failure is part of learning. It's part of improvement. You don't just wake up and you're better. Failure is the way you learn how to fix shit. What you did wrong before and tweak your methods and try something different. Try it a different way.
Yeah, approach it a different angle.
And yeah, it's something you build on.
That's the road to improvement or change, is to constantly be able to make those decisions at every turn.
But when somebody hands you success, or at least removes the economic obstacle, they take away your ability to hone those skills. They take away the motivation altogether. So I don't think as far as the development of the human race, I don't think that's going to be good. It would be detrimental.
Yeah, and since technology is kind of pushing us in that direction, where a lot of things are just instantly accessible and everything's
convenient,
and pretty affordable now, like, since everything's mass-produced, the price goes down so everybody can buy it. We get everything in an instant, so we're all kind of unhappy, and it's kind of shifting things in a way where everyone's a little more isolated, a little unhappy, and nervous. So,
well, even with like technology, it's like I throw a shit fit when my when my computer's not doing what it's supposed to. So we become impatient, you know. We don't. It's like the days of dial up are long. We would not survive.
Yeah. So, yeah, and another thing that kind of came out of the Hegelian dialect thinking is that, like we said earlier, governments can take advantage of this and people. It's something that you can, you can use this information for evil, basically, and try to use it to manipulate people. And by doing this, you can almost create directed thinking. So you know the structures in which people are going to, ways they're going to respond. And I think one way that that happens a lot is through language. It's kind of a weird thing that people need a a lawyer in a society to basically keep you safe from the government. It's kind of almost like a legal bodyguard because nobody knows what you could be taken away over. So, and again, words are something that they're not always received the same way as intended. So you need lawyers to speak in a court for you because other lawyers can twist your words or take something out of context. So another tool that, you know, again, not to sound all conspiratorial, because I don't think it's just like one person directing all this, is just kind of a hole in the human psyche that hasn't really been patched up yet. We are in a situation where we give everyone false enemies to keep people fighting over bullshit, basically. You set up all these, this comes back into the social conflict theory thinking, is that since Marx didn't really believe in individuals, he believed that it was just these groups that fight for power. So the best way to control people like that is to always have them fighting with whatever group you can make up as the enemy. So, you know, for minorities, they go into the ideology of racism, and then that gets, a lot of times, that gets warped into just being anti-white. And, you know, for females, they have the notion of sexism, which a lot of times just ends up turning them anti-men. And a long time ago, a feminist that I used to know, she always argued that, well, no, the definition of feminism is gender equality, but I would always ask her, well, how come you never see women posting about things that are detrimental to men, but that women don't suffer from? Because if that was true to the definition of the word, the way these people would go through life and the ideas they would express would be completely different. So, and even then, if you look at like the etymological meaning of the word, it kind of, I think there's a lot more truth in that than whatever textbook definition there is.
So, feminism.
Yeah, for feminism. So,
well, yeah.
Same thing with racism, because you don't hear too many black people talking about you know, basically issues that whites are facing. So. Even in the LGBT community, like, for them, you know, that kind of went off the rails quick as far as creating a language. So, and it's something that, you know, there's been cases where they get very violent over. But this is all the all these groups, like racism, they have words that can provoke violence. Sexism, there's words that can provoke, you know, violent reactions. And same thing with the whole pronoun game. So
the whole thing, it seems like it takes advantage of black and white thinking.
Yeah.
Because if you have one thing that's good, that automatically makes everything else bad. If you have a sexual preference that is heterosexual, that automatically somehow makes you homophobic or transphobic.
Yeah, like, since now there's the word heteronormative. So that's kind of the words that, that's kind of the word that everyone can, well, at least on the LGBT side, or whatever the new, like, add-on acronyms are, they can basically point at the majority there. Because in conflict theory, it's basically just different groups, and the majority is usually the bad guys. So, the heteronormative people,
they're the minority.
Yeah. So,
if you think of yourself, it's like you start putting all these labels on shit, and then you start thinking in terms of those labels, when it's a lot more, I don't know, it's just, it's not as black and white. It's nothing is black and white except math.
And even then, decimals and stuff like that.
Yeah. But imaginary numbers, algebra. Yeah.
So, like, the weird thing is that people always turn to the state for this. So this is something that governments can really exploit, just to understand that that simplistic part of people that always takes it in a dualistic type way, where good, bad, black, white, you know, male, female, straight, non-straight, abled, disabled. So they always want the government to intervene on their behalf, and basically it grows the authority of the state, which, you know, going back to the concept of collective egos, or as Hegel put it, you know, the nation's mind, it's a way for the state to sustain itself. So,
the state has been conditioning society to do this. That was part of the homeschool lady's whole thing, was that, because everything she talks about is related to public education and homeschooling and that dialectic. So the thing with the state is that it's been conditioning people to put their kids in public school. And the way we're conditioned to do that is just cultural. It's like, it's what everybody does. It's how everybody does things.
Yeah, it's just an accepted ritual.
Then it's further enforced with us having to pay, if you're a homeowner or a property owner, or even if you rent, you're putting into property taxes, which go to your local public schools and public education. That's how it's funded. So you're already paying the taxes and you don't have a choice. So you might as well use the program. You might as well send your kid to public school. So it's like, it's been a long time conditioning. And that's her whole problem with it, is that even, and I don't, it's not apparent whether it's an intentional dumbing down of society or if it's just gone that way because, I don't know, because there's no motivation for people to know shit anymore, for kids to think for themselves.
Yeah, and I think that people and institutions, they, even if it's not, like I said, not verbally clear, I think that the way they act is usually even unaware to themselves. It's done in a way to preserve how they are or how they exist. Mm-hmm. So it does benefit the government to basically waste a person's youth and the ages when they're most capable of learning new things, they're most receptive to it, and fill it with things that aren't really important, little factoids and dates and stuff like that. And basically,
it is so overdone. It is so overdone. And I mean,
they end up doing that, and then the next stage is, okay, well, you're absolutely free. What do you do? So a lot of people get stuck at that phase once they turn 18. They'll either stay on the rails if they want to take the debt, or they can financially afford it, they'll go to college, or they may go to the military because either, you know, they tend to be patriotic or they want the benefits.
The benefits, yeah. They're a big
Or both. Perk. So that's another route those are the main two routes that people take, or they try to get into the workforce, and that's hard because the public school system that we're putting so much money into, it isn't worth anything anymore, because if you try to get any type of work with just a high school education, no one cares about it. So it's something that's been watered down to the point where an employer looks at it and they're like, oh, okay, well, you're not worth all that much. So
yeah,
the cost of it to the society has been pretty bad. And then the next step is you go to college, and if you're not more technically minded and can't get into like the STEM fields, you wind up in the humanities, which has also been corrupted by more rhetoric that enhances the power of the state. So,
but it's all from conditioning. We're conditioned from a young age, elementary, to pay attention, to just accept whatever they throw at us as knowledge. And even then, it's not all factual. It's not all accurate. And some of it is subjective. A lot of it is history. But we're conditioned to just
I think the most dangerous part of the conditioning is that we just give our kids away to the state, basically, at such a young age. Like, as far as it being in the kid's nature to be agreeable and to be accepting of new information, I think that's just how kids are, because that's the best way for them to stay alive at a young age, is to do what the adults say. Otherwise, they get left in the woods.
Yeah, the kids want to do good. They want to please. And when they spend more time at school than they do with their own family,
that becomes a new family. That's who they care about.
The family, yes.
Yeah, so that's kids will come home with, hey, you know, King of the Hill did a good episode on this with Bobby Hill. He mm-hmm. comes home and he's like, hey, did you know we're evil as hell because we killed the Native Americans? And he's like, what? So, and, you know, you give your kids away to the system, and then when they come back with ideas that you don't agree with and that you can't really get through, I mean, you put them in a situation where they think that these are the real authority. Like, those are kind of the main things that keep this whole thing in motion. So, but statism is one of those things that people don't really ever get away from. And like I said, if you can exploit this perspective, you get people to realize that having a state is always necessary. So if you kind of drift outside of that way of thinking, you know, that directed thinking, which, you know, I think a better term is like the Overton window. Once you get outside of what's considered acceptable discussion, you know, there's more like words that they'll place on you to kind of to void your ideas or void that notion because it's just sounding crazy. It sounds cultish. It's whatever. Mm-hmm. So,
and that's another conditioning that takes place in public schools is that if you question the norm, if you question authority, you're labeled as a troublemaker. It's discouraged to think for yourself.
Yeah.
So people graduate and then they just go on to the next thing that is expected of them, which is to either go to college, take on debt, all that. And it just perpetuates. So when you get them young, then, I mean, you're set as far as the state goes. And I don't know if it's so much the people that are in leadership roles, but if there were, like, if you were to think that if there were no, like, leaders, like, if it was just faceless, you know, everybody, the people running it are just staff. The system, if you look at it, is psychopathic in the sense that it's not empathetic to, it doesn't care what people feel. It doesn't care how people want things done or what the people want. It's just the system, and it's basically like a machine. It's the machine.
Yeah.
So then when you get people with, I mean, self-interested employees, government workers who want an income, then they're going to perpetuate that. Yep. And that's one of the things that has concerned me is that the system has gotten so big and there's so many people depending on the system as far as government employees that it just feeds into it more. It's like becoming a cultural norm to go work for a government entity because there's so many, there's so much, there's so many benefits
too. Like,
and there's so many forking benefits.
Yeah, government employees, you know, I've had my friend's parents, they would come to me and say, oh, you should, you know, do this job or that working for the government. And they love it because they get so many benefits. And it's like, well, you know, going back to what you said about the state being psychopathic, like, George Washington had a quote that really explains it, that government is not eloquent, it's not reason, it's force. Mm-hmm. And if you can keep that in mind, which most people, they don't like to because it's a truth that kind of shows the morality of the whole thing. So they'll go through all these different means to rationalize that truth or just simply put it out of mind for the next piece of nonsense that they can say. Mm-hmm. When you keep that in mind, it's not really something you want a part of. So they create a monopoly on the programs that they provide because they have guns to do so. And they have the moral justification from the society who thinks that as well. So the government doesn't have to be productive because it can just take more from people that are to keep themselves in power.
Taxation, taxation, taxation.
Yep.
But even just from like the standpoint of I have a lot of friends from high school who have gone into education careers, and it's like I don't know, it's conflicting to me because they promote it, and based on what I know now, it's like it is not a system that I would morally feel okay with feeding into. Like, if anything, there needs to be less people feeding into it. Because yeah. Education is just not what it used to be.
Yeah, definitely.
In John Taylor Gatto's book, Dumbing Us Down, it goes into a lot of it. And we should go into it sometime because there's a lot of good stuff in there.
Yeah.
And a lot of stuff that people aren't aware of. But one thing I wanted to say is that aside from like replacing the family, it also teaches kids that they aren't smart enough. And they do that by teaching confusion, like Common Core. So with Common Core, it's like, it's trying to teach kids all these different ways of solving, you know, a problem, a mathematical problem, but they're requiring it. It's like, why are they teaching? If you throw too much at a kid, it's just going to be confusing to the point that they're not going to be able to have a an acceptable way of doing it. So by teaching confusion, they are in the same breath telling kids that they're not smart, that they're not capable. So aside from being sheep, we are also taught that we're not capable, or kids now aren't. I think our generation was able to kind of get away from that.
See, and I think it's also capable of the inversion as well. Like, the kids that are doing well, they can kind of end up getting kind of an ego about it. Because
yeah, there's conditioning.
They can still go into, like, I've seen it happen with some of my friends that ended up going into teaching. Like, they were some of the, you know, the top performers in the school. So they go full-blown Marxist, you know?
Yeah, because it's all about how well you can dance to their tune.
Yeah, so if they get the whole academia bug where the state is required and the state wants you to know this or that, then yeah, there's a career for it in them. I mean, there's a career in it for them, so.
Job security.
It's, yeah, job security. So people do, like, end up, like, even if it's unaware to them, like, the things that they exist as a piece of, they do fight to keep it, to sustain it, so.
Yep. A perpetual motion.
You know, everyone's pretty much aware that the government is, like, this gun on the table that all these groups fight for, which... Mm-hmm. I do think that does kind of tie into some truth and conflict theory, because, you know, obviously the whole thing isn't wrong, but I think it does create kind of a lot of space for misinterpretation and misapplication.
Yeah.
So the idea of kind of growing what these things are, and it kind of makes them meaningless. Just like with racism, if you call everything racist, then, well, no one's really racist. And if you call everything rape, then it doesn't mean anything after a while. So it's kind of detrimental to these groups that are using these I don't say victim shields, but the people that are using these tools in an unethical way. So
Go ahead.
Well, I was also going to say, it's kind of interesting, too, because even on the opposite end, like, when it comes to immigration and stuff like that, or different groups feeling like they're not being treated well, the way they go to the state, it happens on both ends. Like, there's diversity quotas, and then the response to that going to just over the top has been, like, ethno-states, people that want, like, an ethno-nation. Mm-hmm. So they still want the state to some degree, and, you know, it's just more justification to apply unethical things. So,
well, it's like a symbiotic thing, because they can't enforce any of this bullshit that they're spouting now without the state.
Right. Yeah.
And the state would have no job if the state gets more power with these people crying victim. So it goes both ways. It's symbiotic.
Yeah.
But so I wonder.
You keep victimizing two different, well, different demographics in ways where they just want more of your own presence to fix it. So I see what you're saying. That's a good point.
Because, mm-hmm. like, one thing that really got me thinking as a female with something that Stefan Molyneux said about women not holding themselves accountable about their choices and what they do and what they think and what, you know, how they act. And it's like, how much, I don't want to like victim blame or whatever, but that's another one of those stupid terms. But I am not entirely.
Don't tell me how I could have done better.
I don't believe in this believe women bullshit. Because it's like, okay, she was there. She had a choice in the matter.
Yeah, see, and that's another thing too. Like, I remember back when that was a thing, believe all women. It was basically throwing out law and order. You just want mob justice, which is, it's a messed up way that some other countries operate, is that someone gets accused of something, so the mob just goes and kills someone or does whatever to them or tortures them. So all it would take is just like a society where someone gets their feelings hurt and everybody comes after them to destroy them. And there's no proof if that person was right or wrong. So that's a horrible way to live.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was pretty happy when that whole Kavanaugh thing blew over. Because that's when everybody was like, me too, believe all women.
See, and again, like, I know most people don't have the capacity for thinking that deep, but if you start getting in a situation like that as a woman, and you have a son, what do you do with that then? Because you've got this entire society hating men. It's like, oh, well, I have a kid. Well, there you go. I guess that's why it's considered so stunning and brave when they transition.
Yes, transition, please, because men are in danger.
Yeah, I just answered my own question there. So I guess that explains it then. That's why you see people that are like women who are getting the state to give them control of their kids, and they can paint their little boys' nails and basically do all this other kind of abuse to them.
Basically force them into feminism.
Yeah. Which, but yeah, there's still a divide there too, because, you know, gays and, well, not gays, but the LGBTs, they go at it too with the feminists all the time, so.
Yeah, see, so even when you're perceivably on the same side, you're not. There's still, like, conflict and competition. And so what I was going to say before is, like, I wonder if, going back to the rape thing, if rape would go up, like, the statistics, because people would not have the burden of economics in a Marxist perfect world, that they would just be, they would need to fulfill themselves in some other way or have that perceived enemy in, at every turn.
You were saying you think that rape would go up in a Marxist world?
I think it would go up.
What about if there's still porn?
Oh, God. I don't think porn quite satisfies, because that's why, I mean, that's why you have a lot of like porn addicts too. Because there's this, it's like an imbalance of a dopamine release or too much like stimulation. And so you become addicted to like your own endorphins.
Rather than what's actually happening.
Rather than how we used to derive pleasure, which was human interaction or going, you know, doing other things, being creative, seeking experiences that are not like sexually related. I'm not talking about sex. I'm just talking about the natural way with which we evolved to, like, we are not evolved to have so much stimulation and pleasure and to be able to handle it.
Yeah.
It's like it's too much, and like people become addicted, and we get all out of whack and out of balance and in our life balance. And that, I think that was one of the like when they first invented smartphones, like they, like, I think, what's his name? The guy that died, the Apple guy,
Steve Jobs.
Yeah, he didn't let his kids have phones. I don't think he even had one aside from working, like developing it. But they knew that these things were going to be addictive.
Yeah, that they're really big distractions.
And it was going to be bad.
Yeah, see, that's interesting. I want to learn more about this whole religious thing that Hegel was going into, because that whole notion of something is arising out of, you know, the acorn or the you know, the cocoon or whatever. So that's, you know, a friend of mine, he's brought the idea that basically people are going to have to evolve to be more mindful. And that's really what it's going to take, because right now just being reactionary and triggered by everything, it's not sustainable, and it's going to make a more and more chaotic society if it all doesn't just like have some type of snap or release, or, you know, whatever that'll look like. Who knows?
I don't know. It's just too convenient. I don't think people are going to be. They're not going to be mindful without some kind of apparent detriment in their immediate life. Yeah. And even then, if there is, I mean, who's to say that that's going to make them hit rock bottom, so to speak?
That's true. And who's to say that the next generation will, you know, keep whatever wisdom that that person gained? So,
well, it's already on the decline. It's like we're not taking care of the acorn. We're not taking care of the plant. We're not taking care of the tree. It's literally shriveling up and dying.
Yeah.
That's my theory. It's dark. I know it's dark. It's fuck.
No, it's. I mean, I agree. It's because the danger now is like it's that dopamine addiction. It's like the tree is being smothered in too much soil, almost like it's really rich, nutrient rich soil that it just can't grow out of.
And not just the soil, but trees go through seasons. They go through the summer and the spring, and then fall and winter. It goes through harshness, and that forces it to grow.
Yeah.
If you look into plant studies, stress actually makes plants grow faster. So yeah, I don't think that we're getting, as a society, we don't have enough of the stress that we need, or that we're actually more avoidant of the type of stress that we actually need for self-development. And instead, we're regressing. That's why everybody's screaming and crying and throwing tantrums when things don't go their way in the elections.
Yeah. I think
dumb shit like that nobody used to even care about.
Yeah. And I've always wondered that too. I wonder if politics has always been like this hot, or if it's just we're older now and we see it now, like, more often. Because I know when I was a kid, I always hear, you don't talk about politics, you don't talk about religion.
Mm.
And I don't know if, because we didn't talk about it, it's finally, it got repressed so much now to where it's like a pimple that's going to pop and everything's going to get nasty and pussy. So.
Well, people had more, like, face-to-face interaction. So if things got heated in a political debate,
that's true,
with like your friend or whatever, shit got real. But now everybody's doing it over the internet, so you get like this buildup of exposure to negative comments or things you don't like to see or whatever. People carry that around and they just fucking explode. Or you get into like these echo chamber bubbles where you think that Hillary Clinton's gonna win, and then all of a sudden she doesn't, because you didn't do your homework on how the fucking system works.
Yeah.
And then you just fucking explode.
That's another thing too about like some of these terms that I feel like they just serve to confuse people. Like the popular vote. I remember back when the election was happening and my mom was still alive, she ended up asking me like, what is the popular vote? Because she had just saw something about Hillary winning the popular vote, but Trump won the Electoral College. And it's basically, they do some think tank things, and they basically believe that more people wanted Hillary to win. They just couldn't vote. So, or they, well, not couldn't vote, they didn't vote. So, you know, what does that mean? The popular vote? The people, the actual voting base, so nobody voted for the votes. Yeah, so, and as far as being able to teach a person how to use information, like how to use that stress and transmute it into something useful, that's one of those things that's really hard to teach. And I think that Hegel kind of, I really like that point that one of the videos brought up about being able to appreciate that. And that's another thing too, and at least what I've heard Alan Watts explain in Taoism is to be able to appreciate the opposition in a way, because if you can look at it, you can learn from it. And like one of my friends is a socialist, like he gets so stressed out after we argue. Like he's one of my gaming buddies, and you know, he threatens to leave or something after that, after he goes, after me and other friends disagree with him over something. And I don't know, even know what to do with it, because after knowing about the Big Five thing, you just see it as a personality trait. It's like, okay, well, that person's prone to stress, so that's just what it's going to look like. So, and if conservatives...
Stress is weird.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, too, because I think about that, too, when it comes to the Big Five, because agreeability and stress. So, like, they say that people that are more disagreeable are more likely to be conservatives, and people that are more neurotic are more likely to be liberal. So, and you know, the opposite, like openness, the people more open are going to be liberal, and the people that are less open are going to be conservative. But at least when it comes to disagreeability and neuroticism, yeah, I mean, I guess it could be different. You can just say no to a lot of things even without thinking about them. You'll just be kind of like, yeah, nah, the old way works better, what I know is better. But
I always default to no.
Yeah.
Because you can always turn a no into a yes, but you can't turn a yes back into a no. Like, you can't take it back.
Yeah, that's true.
But you don't fuck on the first date, dummy.
Or without protection.
There you go. Say no. Just say no. Keep saying no until, you know, feels right. Just say yes on the first fucking request.
Yeah. So, all right, well, it looks like we're coming up on the 1 hour mark. So we're going to go ahead and wrap this up here. Everybody that tuned in, we thank you for spending your time with us. If you enjoyed it and would like to support the podcast, give us a like and subscribe and leave your thoughts below. If you'd like to get at us, we're on YouTube, BitChute, Twitter, MindVectorUSA at Twitter, and our Facebook page, facebook.com/MindVector. So we'll speak with you guys in the next episode.